You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Chris Benner is the director of the Institute for Social Transformation and the Everett Program for Technology and Social Change at UC Santa Cruz, where he is also the Dorothy E. Everett Chair in Global Information and Social Entrepreneurship and a professor of Environmental Studies and Sociology. Manuel Pastor is the director of the Equity Institute Research at the University of Southern California, where he is also the distinguished professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity. They have co-authored 5 books together, including Equity, Growth, and Community, What the Nation Can Learn from America's Metro Areas, and Solidarity Economics, Why Mutuality and Movements Matter. Their new book together is Charging Forward, Lithium Valley, Electric Vehicles, and A Just Future. Thank you for joining me, Manuel and Chris.
Great to be with you.
Good to be with you.
Okay, this is a big subject. It's a small book. It's a magnificent example of brevity is the soul of wit. You start out with a relatively confined topic, you know, the Lithium Valley, this new discovery or old discovery of lithium in the Salton Sea. What made you pick that particular location to enter this particular big discussion of the entire status of EVs on this planet, global climate change, global supply chains? There are other places in America where we have significant and new areas of discoveries of lithium. Why lithium, what we call Lithium Valley?
You know, if you're a storyteller, you often realize that it's the most particular story that it illustrates universal principles, and that the more specific you get, the more concrete and detailed and the fuller and more exact the picture, the bigger the themes can be. And it seemed to us that if you're looking at the issues of just transition, how we move to a clean energy future, how we do that in a way that is equitable and brings people on board into the future, and in particular communities that have been left behind and kept behind, not getting the jobs of the past, but often getting the pollution of the past, that there was no better place than what is now being called Lithium Valley. It's the Salton Sea region, which is a environmental disaster zone, generally considered Salton Sea the most toxic body of water, certainly in California. It's an environmental justice disaster zone, because as the sea has receded, the playa, or shoreline, has kicked up and triggered asthma rates near the sea that are 3 times the national average, often affecting young Latinos in immigrant families in this region. It's a place of tremendous labor exploitation. It's been based on agriculture. It's a place of structural racism. It's 85% Latino. It's been controlled by a conservative white elite. And it's also sitting on enough lithium to completely electrify the entire American auto fleet and have 100 million batteries left over. So if you want to ask, where is the future of clean energy? Where is the future of the auto industry and supply chains? Where is the future of racial politics? Where is the future of community benefits? Where is the future of our planet? You might want to start in Lithium Valley.
Thank you, Manuel. Chris?
Well, and the thing I would add to that is, you know, as you mentioned, Manuel and I have now 6 books together. And much of our work is rooted in working with community-based organizations. And a lot of the work we do with community-based organizations doesn't turn into books. In this case, we were originally invited to work in the Salton Sea region by a woman named Sylvia Paz, who runs an organization called Alianza Coachella Valley in the Eastern Coachella Valley. And she's been working for many years trying to build, address some of the environmental justice challenges that Manuel talked about, but really to build an inclusive economic vision for the Salton Sea region. How do you link environmental regeneration with community economic development and do that in a way that can appeal to the broader state structures as well as local community organizations? Sylvia got appointed as head of a state commission called the Lithium Valley Commission, or really the Blue Ribbon Commission on Lithium Extraction. And was really a key player bringing together private sector voices, public sector voices, community tribes in the area to really look at the implications for this region of lithium as an opportunity. But in the context of recognizing the history of this region doesn't start and end with lithium. I mean, there's literally thousands of years of settlement in this region. And you know, decades of work going in to try and promote inclusive economic development. So as we were working with her to help develop this vision is part of when we realized, hey, there's a story here that touches on these universal questions of a transition to a carbon-free energy system and transportation system globally. And as we move from extracting fossil fuels to extracting the minerals needed for the electric motors and the batteries, which include not just lithium, but cobalt and nickel and manganese and copper and rare earths. You know, how do we do this in a way that not only doesn't create sacrifice zones in those extractive sites, but can actually bring more economic benefits to those regions and create a vision of a circular economy where we deal with the recycling issues and, you know, a whole economic structure that can really present a vision for how a green economy could be a just economy as well.
You know, I would say the other thing that really attracted us to this, although Chris is absolutely right, almost all of our good ideas came from community members who said, hey, maybe you should research this, is that the more and more you dig into the history of the region, you see that it's been a story of schemes, scams, and scoundrels. The Salton Sea itself is the result of an accident. There was a California Development Corporation that was seeking to transform Imperial Valley, then called the Colorado Desert, from being a desert to being a land of agricultural production of different kinds of crops. So they wanted to make sure that they could get the water from the Colorado River to be able to irrigate the desert. So they renamed the desert the Imperial Valley. They tried to get the water from the Colorado River, bringing it through the United States. The federal government objected, so California Development Corporation went ahead and made a deal with a Mexican dictator, Porfirio Diaz, to instead grab the water from the Mexican side, snake it along the Mexican side, and bring it back up into Imperial Valley. Except they made the canal so badly that it broke. And for 2 years, water flooded out and actually took what was the Salton Sink, basically a part of the desert below sea level, turned it into a sea. And that flood was not stopped until the railroad companies, tired of seeing their rail lines get washed out by the flooding, stepped in and helped to reconstruct the canal. There was a scheme, there were scams, there were scoundrels. And if you go through the history of the Salton Sea region, those three things keep coming up again and again. And so one of the things that also makes this very interesting is the suspicion on the part of some people in the community that maybe this is another scam. Maybe there are schemes to just take advantage of the community, and who are the scoundrels? I think in some ways we conclude that there's a lot of good guys sometimes engaged in honest contestation and conflict. But I gotta say, we were attracted by this very scandalous and kind of wonderful history.
You know, one of the things you guys both said was the import of a story, because the story in this book is really great. I mean, it's certainly page-turning, and at the same time, you give us a lot of information. And one of the things I really liked that you did, and you do incredibly well, is to dial this story out from just the specific story of this landscape to investigate product chains. You talk about China, which is fairly scary in itself. And so talk about making the decision to go way, way beyond just the interest of this story. And also, there must be like 8,000 pages of research that go into this book that got, you know, carefully, beautifully edited out to turn it into a kind of a, you know, a page turning, oh my God, what are we going to do about all this? And is there any good conclusion possible? So talk about, you know, looking at the story and bringing in the big picture to buff up and explain the import of the smaller picture.
Well, you mentioned the 8,000 pages of academic research and reports. There are footnotes in the book that are people are interested in that they can search that out. But yeah, we really wanted to write this as almost a journalistic account of this story, a heavily researched journalistic account, because we think it's important for people to hear. And part of what I think was important is, you know, the attention of the world really is on Lithium Valley now, in part because it's the cleanest, greenest source of lithium really on the planet. At the moment, lithium comes from two major sources, hard rock mining, in which Australia is the world leader, with all the environmental destruction that goes on with kind of open pit mining. The other place is in Chile and Argentina, in the high desert region, where there's lithium in salty brines, but it's at ambient temperature. And the way they source it there is to create huge evaporation ponds, and the water evaporates. So it's a tremendous loss of water in what are sensitive, you know, wetlands and aquifer areas. It's a very dry area. So any loss of water is a real problem. And in that process, they actually only get out about half of the lithium in that brine. In the Salton Sea region, in Lithium Valley, the brine is in geothermal, deep water, super hot brines that are brought to the surface to run currently 11 different geothermal plants in the region. And to get the lithium, the process is to add on to this system large, essentially filtration plants. They call it direct lithium extraction. You extract out the lithium and then re-inject the brine down into this deep underground aquifer. So it's a closed loop system in which you're both generating renewable energy and getting out this critical mineral for the green transition. And so, you know, it's not just people locally who are paying attention to lithium extraction, but actually, you know, major multinational corporations and a lot of, you know, global policy advocates who are really trying to push for a green transition recognize the value of lithium in this place. You mentioned other places in the United States that are exploring and developing lithium. At the moment, there's only one relatively small evaporation pond plant in Nevada that's operating, but a huge new mining operation has started in a place called Thacker Pass in northern Nevada. And it's really a contrast between, you know, how it could be done right in Lithium Valley with ideally the support of, you know, local communities with labor benefits and this cleanest, greenest source of lithium. In Thacker Pass, they have had to overcome multiple lawsuits from local indigenous communities, environmental organizations are all pointing out the problems of trying to do a, you know, extractive, polluting mine to promote a green industry, and the contradictions in that. It's really the wrong way to make this transition. And so that's part of why Lithium Valley is so important to look at.
So to pick up on another part of that question, one of our sort of slogans about the book is come for the analysis, stay for the story. And thank you for noticing that, Rick, because one thing that we did was we were very disciplined. For example, I banned the word thus. It appears a couple of times, but thus seemed like a academic word. And I've dared people reading it to find ideological statements, academic statements, rather than something that's just moving the story along. And I think that one of the things that, I mean, I think it's highly analytical as a book too, and there are policy lessons that could pull at the end. But I think that one of the gaps, it's certainly something we've seen in the last weeks with the election results, is the inability of academics to explain complex ideas in ways that actually capture the public imagination. And so that's a little bit of what we were trying to do. Another thing I think that you lifted up is that the story has many scales to it. So we actually start at the global issue of the climate crisis, our political crisis, our economic crisis. We then kind of telescope down through the auto industry and take a look at the role that the auto industry played in forming an agreement between workers and companies in the post-war period, how that also led to sprawl and suburbia and segregation and climate change, and then try to ask some questions about the recent set of strikes in 2023 in the auto industry and what they signal about trying to rebalance the relationship between capital and labor before diving deep into Lithium Valley and then concluding that what starts in Lithium Valley will not stay in Lithium Valley. And so we zoom back out to lessons for just transition. So story is important. Scale is important, and a third S is important, soul. We keep coming back to deep questions of how people connect with one another, to the planet, to social struggles, to ideas of justice. And I think readers will find that it's not as dry as the desert. It's perhaps illuminating as we hope we a good story can be.
One of the things that interested me was that for you, it must be a really strange feeling. This book was conceived, I'm guessing, at least during the Biden administration, and when there was a lot of hope about, the green transition, and you do a great job of pointing out the power of what was called eventually the Inflation Reduction Act, which is really a giant step in green power and the new Green Deal, as it was called. Now we find ourselves in a different corner of the Marvel Universe. It is like, a complete change in reality. Talk about, I think one of the things I think you do very well in this book is you stick to reality to give us, figures and facts and things that matter that are incontestably part of the real world and real experience and also the real experience of the people in this place. Talk about the import of that in essentially, a parallel world. It's the Star Trek mirror universe.
I'll say something first then, Chris, which is, just recently, the CEO of ExxonMobil came out and warned Trump that he should not pull out of the Paris Climate Accords. Now, when the heads of major fossil fuel industries are admitting that this is a serious problem and we're going to move in a different direction, although clearly they would like to move more slowly than climate advocates, that's pretty significant. When you think about the fact that Elon Musk, who pioneered EVs in the United States in the recent era, has the ear of Donald Trump. That's interesting. When you think of the way in which the major auto companies have retooled to electric vehicles, and the way in which most of those investments have actually gone to red states, so that governors who might have supported Trump for president are still salivating at battery plants and EV assembly. When you think about the fact that Europe is not as stupid as we are, and they are going to continue on the course of addressing climate. When you think about the fact that China is trying to capture the worldwide EV industry, they did a big set of state subsidies for about a decade. They've really removed them now, but those companies are well placed to flood the zone with cheap EVs that actually, and EVs actually at all ranges of luxury production, and but also a set of inexpensive EVs that are actually probably going to capture markets in the developing country. When you think about the superiority of electric vehicles to gas vehicles, with the only objections being the question about range or your desire to be able to roar loudly your giant truck in order to terrorize the people around you. We're on a track. And I think this is going to slow that track down. I actually am not, and I think there's going to be a lot of threats from the Trump administration with regard to climate, certainly with regard to immigrant rights. Whether or not EVs get really permanently derailed, I'm not so sure. I'm wondering what Chris is thinking in this moment.
Well, I actually am pretty optimistic in this moment about the EV industry. One thing that is a bit ironic is that, you know, Elon Musk benefited tremendously from public subsidies, and really the public created the EV industry. And in many ways, the federal government is kind of late to the game with the Inflation Reduction Act. And just to flesh that out a little bit.
You put that in the book so well, I thought, how much Musk and Tesla owe the federal government for all the subsidies and the, you know, cash back on your EV purchase.
Well, it's really remarkable. And just to kind of spell that out for the listeners here, I mean, California put in place the first zero emission vehicle regulation in 1990. And period after that, they actually created a zero emission vehicle credit system where actually other companies who couldn't reach the targets of zero emission vehicles actually ended up paying Tesla for their credits. And of course, Tesla was only producing electric vehicles, so they reached the target with no problem at all. And, you know, the importance of that in the early stage of the EV industry really can't be overstated. I mean, in 2009, at a time when Tesla was, you know, people didn't know if it was going to be successful or not, actually 85% of their gross margin actually came from the zero emission vehicle credits from other companies. And even up to today, they're getting $2 billion a year in payments from this credit revenue system. And, you know, one of the things that just kind of blew me away when I first saw it in December of 2023 of Tesla's market value at that point was more than the next 9 automakers combined. As of yesterday, it was actually more than the next 16 automakers combined. I mean, there's hardly a better example of like public investment and subsidies creating value than that. And yet now Elon Musk is saying, we need to cut down government and not provide support. I think it's a huge misreading of what's critical for the development of the electric vehicle industry. But I think the second point, as Manuel was saying, I mean, electric vehicles are better vehicles. It's not just that they're better for the environment, but they're, you know, they're cleaner, they're quieter, they're getting cheaper, the ones that are coming in China, and that'll happen in the US, I think, in the next few years. I mean, I think there's enough of a momentum in the economic dynamics of the industry at the moment that it's going to move ahead. Now, whether the US participates in that effectively or not, I think is a huge question. I mean, one of the things about the Inflation Reduction Act is it was trying to address 30 years of a lack of an industrial policy in this country, where we have not invested in, you know, the science and the technology that's been critical for the lithium battery industry, and trying to make up for that. If the Trump administration doesn't continue some form of that, you know, China's moving ahead, and that will help spread around the rest of the world, whether we want to benefit from that or not. So I think the electric vehicle industry is going to expand. And as Manuel said, Europe is, you know, doubling down on it at the moment and really helping to support it. So yeah, we'll just have to see. But I think the economics of it are pointing in the right direction.
I think the question is whether or not the equity aspects will be lifted up or not.
Exactly.
And I think what this book is pointing to is the point that Chris made, that public policy created this, so there should be real clear public benefits or dividends from those investments. And that paying attention to these questions of equity is the right thing to do, not just morally, but economically.
You know, that's one of the aspects of the book that I think really makes it, is the way you tie all this together to real people in a real place and real problems that come out of the history of that place. Talk about, you know, the research you did on the ground in Lithium Valley, talking to the people and the characters who really entranced you, and I think who are, you know, set to really lead a revolution, not just economically and not just in terms of the boosting the technology, but also in terms of social justice and righting some of the wrongs that have, you know, just been exacerbated in the past by these scams and scoundrels who populated the place.
Well, there are so many people we could talk about, but let me lift up a couple of really interesting. I mentioned Sylvia Paz and the work of trying to link a vision for the region of an inclusive economy with this lithium opportunity. One of the other major community leaders in the area is a guy named Luis Olmedo, who runs an organization called Comité Cívico del Valle, which is really one of the most effective environmental justice organizations, certainly in California and possibly across the country. And they're really leading the effort, along with a group called the Imperial Valley Equity and Justice Coalition, to ensure that the region doesn't become a sacrifice zone in this transition to a green economy. So, you know, they're really looking at the water use in this process. It's still uncertain how much water is going to be used, and is it possible how much can be recycled as part of the filtering process. There will be some increased waste produced in filtering out lithium, because there are other materials in the brine that get filtered out, and some of that includes lead and arsenic. So some of it is toxic and needs to be disposed of in safe places. There will be increased truck traffic with the lithium being shipped in and out, so all the diesel fumes that are part of that. And so they've been really paying a lot of attention to the environmental impact reports going on. But another thing I'd really point to is the United Auto Workers, and they have created a new center for manufacturing in the green economy. Manuel mentioned earlier the sort of compromise that was made in the auto industry, the Treaty of Detroit in the 1950s. And essentially that was a compromise where the UAW ensured that workers were getting decent wages and working conditions, but left production decisions to the decision of management. And some of the strikes last year were about saying, hey, actually, we need to be extending the conditions in the auto industry to the battery industries that are connected to that as well. And the Center for Manufacturing in the Green Economy is about saying, we want to pay attention to workforce development, to training industries, to the kind of subsidies that are needed to promote high road manufacturing in places like the Salton Sea region and in California, and working with new employers that are really trying to build out the battery manufacturing and other industries there. So it's a new role for unions. There's another organization called Jobs to Move America that's working also heavily in the battery industry in southern states, the places that Manuel mentioned that are benefiting from a lot of these subsidies in the Inflation Reduction Act, with leaders in the states who don't believe in climate change. Jobs to Move America is working really closely with community organizations and four or five different unions to ensure that these new plants have decent employment conditions, and also beginning to work now in Imperial Valley. And again, bringing the attention of national unions, international unions, to support the local community organizing in the area. I could go on, but there's like the local community college, Imperial Valley College, is really working closely with both the companies in the area and local community organizations to provide the training needed for plant operators and chemical technicians to ensure that new jobs that are created are actually hiring local residents of Imperial County and not importing skilled labor from elsewhere. So yeah, there's a lot of really inspiring people and work going on in the ground there. Manuel, what would you add?
Well, the colorful characters do not stop. So for example, this Ivy Equity and Justice Coalition came together from a group of young people, some in college, some who had graduated, Latinx, who during COVID moved back to be with their families in a place that really saw a lot of illness from COVID because it was farm work. So people continuing to go to work, overcrowded conditions, historic lack of care. And it's that young group of people who came back, got angry at the injustice, began organizing in Zoom, ran a former UC Santa Cruz student, Raul Reyes, economics major, for the city council of Calexico, first transgender person elected to an ethnic any council in Imperial County, very progressive, served two terms, has been recalled because of a very colorful right-wing set of movements who actually screamed at us when we were down there doing some videotaping, including interviewing people. The head of one of the major firms, Controlled Thermal Resources, is a guy named Rod Caldwell, who managed to call legislators who passed an excise tax on lithium clowns. Which is not sort of a strategy to endear yourself to legislators, but it's colorful. And you also have their president, Jim Turner, very sincere guy who came up through the region, sees the tremendous possibilities, thinks that this development is really going to help people. When we were at their main lithium extraction place, meeting a young Latino engineer who in the past would have had to move away to ply his trade, but can do it now because of the development that's taking place. A county supervisor, Brian Kelly, who comes from a long historic family, has tremendous concern for the region, has teamed up at times with community justice advocates, has fought bitterly at times with those same advocates, but someone who is sincerely concerned about the future of the region. So the people are really inspiring, compelling. Their stories are really what kept us engaged.
You know, it strikes me that the people are the most important part of this equation, especially the locals, because there are so many people who come in and just the potential for creating some kind of new form of dystopian terror is right there. And so I'd like you to also talk about the technology, which seems really important and somewhat underplayed, because this seems like a really great, you know, geothermal power and clean lithium out of this, or relatively clean lithium, out of the same place, which is just remarkable in many ways, but dependent on technology. This isn't just, you know, shoveling a mop, digging a big hole in the ground and taking the rocks out.
Well, and I'll have to say it took a long time to really understand the technology. And, I'm still not an expert in the field. We aren't. But, one of the things that your question points to, though, I'll say is that to do this transition that we need so much as a planet requires some level of cooperation with capital. Only the multinational corporations have the technology and the technological sophistication to be able to do that. So it's been pushing the boundaries of many of the local labor and community organizations who have this history that Manuel described so well of scoundrels and scams, and figuring out how do you work in a way with capital, with major corporations, in a way that is true to the needs and benefits and dividends for local communities, but also can take advantage of these opportunities. But to get to the technology itself, so it's a deep underground, about 5 to 8,000 feet, wells that are driven, bringing super hot brine to the surface. It has to run a generator, so steam comes out and runs the generator. Before it can run the generator, they actually have to pull out silica. There's a lot of silica in the brine that, if it were to cool in the machinery, it actually, hardens and would actually corrupt the machinery itself. And to do the direct lithium, they really have to get out almost 100%. For the geothermal, it's about 95% of the silica, if I'm remembering right. But it's got to be a more filtering out process of the silica first. The lithium itself is filtered out through an adsorption process. There's a material that kind of preferentially attracts lithium ions. And then you rinse out the material with fresh water to get the lithium out of it. It's been described to us as basic high school chemistry, like it's been proven, it's done, people know how to do it on a pilot scale. But how do you do it at a commercial scale? With literally it'll be 20,000 metric tons of lithium extracted out of this brine a year from each of those plants. Very salty, very hot. It starts off at over 500 degrees temperature. They cool it down to about 200 degrees before they are able to extract out the lithium. And no one knows yet what it's going to take to run that at a commercial scale. It has not been done with hot brine at a commercial scale anywhere. It's probably going to take a fair amount of maintenance, periodic shutting down the machine to clean all the, salty and mineral buildup on it. So uncertain about how much of a cost that's going to be for maintaining the system. It's almost as much a mechanical engineering problem as a chemical engineering problem. That's just on the extraction end. Then there's all the technology involved in building batteries. And the chemical construction of batteries actually makes a huge difference. Up to this point, most of the batteries that are in electric vehicles have a combination of nickel, manganese, and cobalt in them, along with the lithium. And you have to get the crystalline structure of that just right. To get, the kind of characteristics that we come to expect, the cycle times, how many times can you charge it and discharge it before it starts losing performance? How rapidly can you charge it? How does it perform in cold weather and very hot weather? All of that differs depending on the structure of the batteries. And there's now a move actually towards more lithium iron phosphate batteries. They're called LFP batteries. Part of that is because cobalt is very expensive and has lots of environmental problems and human rights problems in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is where most of the world's cobalt comes from. But lithium phosphate batteries, iron phosphate batteries, actually are less dangerous in terms of the potential to have short circuits and turn into flaming batteries, which can happen very rarely, but can happen. And so, actually, Tesla now about half of their batteries are LFP batteries. They don't perform as well in very cold weather. Some people may remember last January there was a cold spell, and there were a bunch of stranded Tesla vehicles in Chicago and other places in the north because they couldn't hold the charge or charge as well in very cold weather. But they have other performance features that make them better, easier to manage. So the chemical composition of these batteries makes a huge difference. And there's actually talk now about sodium ion batteries, salt. has very similar chemical characteristics to lithium. It's heavier than lithium, so not as appropriate for electric vehicles, but is very appropriate for energy storage, for solar and wind energy, and our need to have storage facilities because the sun doesn't shine 24 hours and the wind doesn't blow all the time. So you need to store the energy there for times when the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing. And sodium ion batteries might start to get into that market. So, you know, taking advantage of this opportunity in Lithium Valley, we often talk about the balance between moving at the speed of trust with local community organizations and speed of the market. Because it's possible that this market for lithium batteries might have a finite lifetime.
And I think that lifts up one thing I'd like to key on from the question you asked, because you used the word dystopia, and it's clearly a case this could go wrong and there would be dystopia. It's also possible to characterize our current situation as dystopia, cooking our planet, underinvesting in our young, corroding democracy by the moment. But what I want to suggest is that this book argues that the opposite of dystopia is not utopia. Utopia is where everything's perfect. We're arguing for reality. We're arguing for what, there's a great expression in Spanish, factible, something that could actually be done. So what can we conceive of that could happen in the next 10 years that would improve people's lives? What are the community benefits programs that need to be put in place? What's the way that we need to contest with and then collaborate with these giant corporations? What should the public be doing about insisting on a return to its investments in public policy and the mandates around zero emission vehicles? What kind of deals need to be struck? What kind of job training needs to be put in place? One thing Chris talks a lot about is what kind of accountability, that is, how do we measure where these minerals come from, the conditions under which they are extracted, so that we as consumers can say, we want to go to the kind of EV that has union labor, that its batteries are assembled in conditions of dignity and environmental protection. And we need to get real about this future. So we're living in dystopia, but if we just hope for utopia, we're going to be dreaming without effectiveness. That's been a problem for a lot of our progressive forces.
That's one of the things I liked about this book. I thought it had an admirable spirit of pragmatism in that it focused on what was practically real. Now, one community I wanted to just mention was the Coahuila Indians. Native American tribes seem to be everywhere. All the incredible mineral deposits are discovered, and often they are moved shortly after that discovery or maybe shortly before. So talk about the importance of the tribal politics. And also, you said that in the book, you write that the people who are... as you say, moreover, the disparate actors seeking to tame corporate power are not always on the same page, with differences evident in terms of strategy, geographical base, and immediacy of need. How, I'm thinking that in a sense, your book and the conversations you had on the ground with those people actually helped to bring them closer together. And how much of an effect do you think that your book, the creation of your writing, and the research you did in this area had to help matters tilt in the correct direction for justice and power, electric power, that is?
Well, you've got a lot in that question. Let me talk a little bit about indigenous communities in the area. So, you know, today there's three broad groupings. It's the Kawia, the Ketsan, and the Kumayai who've had some engagement in the US around this. There's also the Cocopa in Mexico, you know, who lived in this area for at least 10,000 years before Western settlement. And just to say, you know, the accident that created the current Salton Sea was Colorado River water flowing in there from a broken canal. But the Colorado River, before we dammed it, you know, used to meander along with the delta and the sediment that gets created. And periodically, that would flow into the Salton Sink rather than the Gulf of Mexico and create a lake that, you know, Lake Cahuilla, it's actually much bigger than the current Salton Sea. And indigenous peoples, you know, adapted over time to when there was water in the sea, lots of fish, a lot more bird life, you know, that was much more of their life. But then, you know, when it would dry up in other periods, spending much more time up in the mountains and other food sources. Today, the two tribes that were represented on the Blue Ribbon Commission on Lithium Extraction were the Torres Martinez Desert Cahuilla Indians and the Quetzon tribe. And by and large, the Quetzon tribe has been really opposed to development of lithium in the area, seeing it as a violation of sacred land and really wanting to preserve the environment. The Torres Martinez Desert Cahuilla Indians are trying to figure out what are the economic opportunities for what's one of the poorest tribes in California, and are there ways they can take advantage of this that are consistent with the values of the tribe itself. And part of one of the ironic things, or maybe ironic isn't the right word, but they are independent nations and are not subject in the same way to the California Environmental Quality Act. They do have to follow federal environmental issues, but they could actually permit new factories much quicker than land that is in Imperial County or Riverside County. And so that's part of why many companies have been going to the Torres Martinez tribe to talk about opportunities for development there. Last we were in touch with them, they were looking particularly at opportunities for battery recycling, which is actually the part of the industry that we know is already operational and existing because we have lithium batteries now that need to be recycled. And they see that as an immediate opportunity. From what we understand, also the Kumeyaay tribe is pretty opposed to development of lithium in the area. They're a little farther distant at the moment in their current areas, but also don't see opportunities. So as you say, there's lots of different voices, even within indigenous communities, much less between local communities and public and private sector.
Torres Martinez also have an unusual configuration of the reservation, which is a legacy of the railroads. When the railroads went through the United States, federal government set up land in these sort of square mile blocks where one would be federal land, then private, then federal, then private. And they did that on checkerboard on the grounds that this would induce private development around railroad lines. But that was the land configuration in place when they were distributing land to the Torres Martinez. So the Torres Martinez have a reservation, which is checkerboard in its land configuration, which makes it difficult to do economic development because you need to assemble different pieces together. And I think it's not quite half of their land actually is under the Salton Sea because the land distribution occurred before the flooding did. So it's one of the many reasons why the Torres Martinez are the poorest Indian tribe in California. Chris said one of the poorest, I think kind of depends on the year, but they're definitely there.
One of the things I think that's interesting about this book, as I read it, I thought, well, this is incredibly well written, much like what you describe as the legislation that helped create some of the beneficial conditions for the in the Inflation Reduction Act. I mean, it's being able to write codes and regulations is at the center of what's going to happen here. Are either of you involved in helping craft legislation or working with some of the social justice movements, just in terms of you know, getting the writing right? What's in the writing is important, as we know, by virtue of, you know, the very labyrinthine acts around California's water, which are just like, it's scary.
Well, one of the things, and this is more forward-looking at the moment than is detailed in the book, but it's something that Manuel pointed to, of the importance of transparency and accountability across the entire electric vehicle supply chain. And I want to lift up for your listeners, there is an organization or a coalition of groups called Lead the Charge. And you can go to their website, leadthecharge.org, that is rating automobile companies on their level of transparency across the whole supply chain in terms of environmental conditions, in terms of human rights conditions, in terms of child labor, starting from the extraction of minerals through all the manufacturing process, and rates them. So as a consumer, you can choose, you know, which electric vehicle you want to buy based on how well they're performing across their supply chain. Now, the problem with that is that's, you know, voluntary and depends on consumer sentiment, which can have some impact, but we really need regulation behind that. The European Union is going the pathway of what they call a battery passport, and it's essentially creating QR code type system linked to a blockchain database that any battery sold in the European Union would have to have this system of documenting the environmental, human rights, and labor conditions across the entire supply chain, from the raw materials to the battery manufacturing, and then ensuring that they're meeting EU regulations around those environmental and labor conditions. That's something that California could be a leader in the United States of. You know, any battery sold in California could be required to have that kind of battery passport. So, yeah, we'd love to start working with people in the California Energy Commission and the legislature to see what it would take to put that kind of system in place. And people are talking about it.
And I think another role that we've played is facilitating philanthropic attention and investments to support the community-based organizations. Because in this moment of transition, they really need two sets of skills. One is power building skills. Many of them have. That is, how do you force your way onto a table? But then after you're there, do you understand the supply chain? Do you understand how high a tax can go? Do you understand what job training programs need to collaborate with the community college, even as you're insisting on local hiring so people actually fit into the jobs? And so we're trying to help philanthropy understand how to invest in local organizations and local governments to do a better job.
New book by Chris Benner and Manuel Pastor is Charging Forward, Lithium Valley, Electric Vehicles, and a Just Future. They will be appearing at Bookshop Santa Cruz on Thursday, November 21st at 7 p.m., come join them to ask more questions and just to buy this wonderful book with a great story that looks forward to a brighter future. Thank you for joining me, Manuel and Chris.
Thank you so much for having us. Real pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for having us. And we promise the bookshop visitors that we will have additional stories of schemes, scams, and scoundrels. It gets spicy.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.